Welcome back, my fellow peanuts, and welcome to anyone new to my channel or to my podcast. Now, this podcast covers true crime cases that may not be suitable for young listeners. There may be graphic and violent content. Listener discretion has been advised. Now, today's serial killer is definitely one we've all heard of. And for sure, if you do love true crime, you would have definitely watched some documentaries. We've got a ton of information on him. We've got some really detailed confessions. And our serial killer today is BTK. Bind him, torture him, kill him. Now, he was otherwise known as Dennis Rader, and our state is Kansas. Who doesn't love Kansas, by the way? Now, I have to say that I did really enjoy watching Mindhunter on Netflix. It actually depicts really well his crimes in the background. Now, there are some really interesting documentaries as well. In almost all of them, Carrie, his daughter, actually is featured, and she talks about her father, his crimes. She really delves into her childhood and also what he was like as a man and as a father. And the person that she knew was nothing like the monster of BTK. Now, shoot me a comment in the sections below if you want the names of those documentaries. I'm more than happy to share any of that info. But now let's begin BTK's story. Dennis Rader was born in 1945 in Pittsburgh, Kansas. This town is really close to where Kansas, Oklahoma, and Missouri will meet. I thought that was actually a really cute fact. He would be the eldest of four boys, and his parents were William and Dorothea Rader. His dad was in the US Marines, and after he retired from the US Marines, he would actually be a gas worker for the Kansas Gas and Electricity. The family would eventually move to Wichita. There's not a great deal of information on his childhood, but what we do have, I think we can discuss where his problems really began. Now, I've got mixed reports on his mum and his dad. Some say that his parents would work too much and they would basically make him feel like he was ignored. But in one particular article, it talks about a conversation that a psychologist, Catherine Ramsland, would have with him. She would eventually write a book on him. There's about 10 years worth of conversations. And she does briefly, well, not briefly, but she goes into his childhood. And Dennis would actually tell her that he felt humiliated by his mum and that he would carry that through his childhood and through his life. He really did, from the outside, seem like a really normal boy, though. He would join the Boy Scouts. He would attend Riverview Elementary School. He talked about at length, though, during his confessions and with psychologists, how he would have some really sick, sadistic fantasies from really quite a young age. Now, he would want to seek out power again over women and using bondage and torture specifically. There's a direct quote from Catherine where she says he wanted to feel significant and he wanted power over women because females made him feel off balance. He didn't like that he was the oldest boy because he was expected to be strong and masculine, and yet they seemed to kneecap him left and right without even trying, just by being female. And his fantasy life certainly would propel this. So even from a young age, he was having these fantasies about wanting to have power and wanting to have control over women. So in this essence, and I agree with some of the articles that I've read, it does seem like there was something towards women from the get-go. And often that is built off the relationship with the mum. Catherine said he was like a serial killer she'd never experienced. He seemed to have a really good childhood. He didn't seem to have any anger towards his family or anything like that. He was married. He had two kids. He was really ingrained in society and very, very normal. We don't really know what triggers or what starts someone on this pathway, but Dennis was definitely one in a million when it comes to how he began all this. I thought I would just discuss that, just because he's not like, I don't have much on his childhood, but what I do have, it's not quite like what we've done on my previous podcast, where you can see the trauma from really, really young. It doesn't seem like there's trauma. It just seems like Dennis wanted to hurt women from get-go. So when Dennis would reach puberty, he would begin to have a lot more fantasies and wanting to have his way with women quite forcibly. Now, one of his favorite fantasies involved a girl that was on TV. She was actually a musketeer by the name of Annette Funicello, I think is how you say it. Now, we'd have some pretty sick fantasies about imaginary bondage and torture in regards to her specifically. But during his confessions, he would even admit to animal torture, and he would also entertain in fantasies about wearing women's underwear and fetishes and ropes and strangulation. I might add, guys, this is not in any way, shape or form like I'm not having a crack at BDSM or anything like that. I think everyone is entitled to their own fantasies and their own life and all that kind of stuff. We're talking he's wanting to use it in a way that's not healthy. He's wanting to use it to harm people. So when I do talk about the fantasies and all that kind of stuff, please don't think I'm having a crack at anybody's like BDSM sort of things, because there is definitely a big difference. Now, he would start stealing neighbors' underwear, and he'd start those fantasies who really come to life. But the people who did know him around that age, they would describe him as really quiet and polite, a guy who would just prefer his own company rather than of others. Dennis was a bit of a loner. He didn't really like to socialize. He much preferred to study. There was even a comment in one of the articles that he just lacked a sense of humor completely. But it was really well mentioned that he was really careful with his words, and he would give you his full attention when you spoke to him. So that's quite contradictory, right? Like, he's living this life of sick fantasies, but he's also got this really polite and gentle exterior. Now, in 1963, he'd graduate from Wichita Heights High School. He'd briefly attend Kansas Wesleyan College for 2 semesters, but in 1966, at the age of 21, he joined the USA Air Force. Now, during his active duties, he'd be stationed in Okinawa, Korea, Greece, Turkey, as well as Texas and Alabama. And while in the Air Force, he would actually attain the rank of sergeant. He would install antenna equipment and other tasks that haven't really been recorded. He would receive the Air Force Good Conduct Medal, Small Arms Expert Marksmanship Ribbon, and the National Defense Service Medal. He would be discharged from active service in 1970, but he'd spend a further 2 years in the reserves, and he would return to Wichita. In 1971, he would marry Paula Diaz. Now, they attended the same high school, but the way that they would actually meet is through church, and they would marry within months of meeting. Now, she'd spend the next 30 or so years oblivious to the fact that she was married to BTK. And by the way, no way, shape, or form is that a form of judgment, okay? Just how good Dennis was at hiding this side of himself, which is really not uncommon in instances of serial killers. So we've seen it with Jeffrey Dahmer, we've seen it with Ted Bundy especially, we've seen it with John Wayne Gacy, which is, by the way, guys, I can't wait to do a podcast on him because he had a really interesting life. So it's just really interesting that they're able to hide this part of themselves so well. It certainly seeps through in certain aspects, but I don't think it did with Dennis. Now, he would have a bunch of odd jobs over the next couple of years. He'd attend Butler County Community College, and he'd earn an associate degree in electronics. That took about 2 years, but shortly after completing this, he'd enroll in Wichita State University, and it'd take him 6 years to complete a Bachelor of Science degree majoring in the Administration of Justice. We're going to come back to that in a second. Now, Dennis would say he wasn't the greatest of students. He was getting mainly C minuses and Ds. And there is some speculation that he had a learning disability given his poor grammar. The letters he would write to the police and to the media, it certainly appeared like he had a problem with grammar. But I do have to wonder, though, if he was doing this on the purpose to mask who he really was, because he does seem quite intelligent. Now, I do want us to head back just really quickly to the fact that he got a degree in justice, or majored in justice, I'm sorry. So he had a criminal justice degree and he was doing this. So one has to think, did he do this as a part to learn of what criminal procedures were? Was it a little bit of a statement to the police, a bit of an F you? Hey, I know your processes, I know your procedures. But it's a little bit of a, oof, okay. So in January 1974, he bit between jobs, and this would lead to him starting to feel really restless, and it would really start the pathway to him becoming a serial killer. Now, he'd be driving his wife to and from work, but while it was snowing, she just really didn't feel very comfortable driving in that weather. And while he was unemployed and not doing much else, he would troll the neighbourhood, and he'd start to have some really sadistic fantasies about the people who he would encounter. He would obviously turn these fantasies into real life. Now, Dennis would spot a new family who'd moved into the neighbourhood. They would be the Otero family. Now, he would say during his confession that he really liked the look of Hispanic women and girls, that it made him stop and specifically look at this family. He liked the girls' dark hair and their features. On the morning of January 15th, 1974, he would bring these fantasies that he'd been having for years to life. During his confession, he would say that he didn't know that Mr. Otero, he didn't know the family personally, but he had selected them to be his victims because he did like the look of the family. Very, very much so the daughter. He would cut their phone lines. Now, this had become a really common theme in most of his murders, and he'd wait by the back door. He hadn't realised, though, that Mr. Otero would be home. He almost hesitated going ahead with it when he discovered this factor. Unfortunately for this family, he would continue, though. The family dog didn't take too well to him breaking into the house, so he would, while holding them at gunpoint, demand that that dog be taken outside so he couldn't be hurt. He would pull out his gun really early on. He'd tell the family that he was on the run from the police and he needed money, food, and a car. Just so my listeners are aware, the family that was home that day was Joseph Otero Sr., his wife, Julie, she was 33, Joey, who was 9, who happened to be their son, and their daughter, Josie, who just turned 11. Now, I'm going to read out loud a direct quote from his confession. "There I realized that, you know, I didn't have a mask or anything, that they could ID me, so I made the decision to go ahead and put them down, I guess, or strangle them." I think the original plan for him was to do some sexual perversions and putting some of those bondage fantasies to life that he thought of previously, though he would bring a kit of ropes, ties, and a gun. I'm guessing that that particular kit was more around to tie them up and to get them to comply. I don't know if the murder kit yet, but I'm guessing it didn't involve in his original plan, and perhaps it was a last alternative if something had gone right. Now, Dennis would tie the family up. He'd bring them into a bedroom. The father, Joseph, was the first to be murdered. Now, he fought really hard to stay alive. He'd initially have a bag placed over him, and he would claw and tear holes into that bag. So Dennis would have to improvise, and he'd actually use a cord and place another bag over his head and use that to strangle and suffocate him. But just what a horrific way to die. Just horrendous. Now, Julie would be the next, and her death was really excruciating. He would manually strangle her at first, but he really didn't realize how hard that actually was. So she didn't die initially, and he would in the end have to use a rope to strangle her. Joey, the little boy, was next. He was taken into another bedroom and he was also killed with a plastic bag. Josie, before that, he'd actually already attempted to strangle her, but she actually got revived. So he would take her to the basement where she would die by being hung up. The next part may disturb some of my listeners or viewers. Dennis would then masturbate over her dead body, as apparently he was living in that fantasy, but he would actually leave evidence of his enjoyment on a pipe in the basement. The next part again is a direct quote. This time it's from his trial when the judge actually asked him questions about the murder itself. "I went through the house, kind of cleaned up. It's called the right-hand rule. You go from room to room and pick everything up. I think that I took Mr. Otero's watch, and I guess I took the radio. I had forgotten about that, but apparently I took the radio. Now, Dennis would then take their car and park it at a nearby supermarket, Dillon's, and he claimed that he would go back to the Otero house because he realised his knife was missing, and he would then return and retrieve it, but then he'd go home, no one not wiser. Now, perhaps the most tragic part of this family, I mean, other than obviously the death of this family, is that the remaining Otero children, Charlie, 15, Daniel, 14, and Carmen, 13, were the ones that would find their family upon return from school. So that's just really, really tragic. Like, they have to live with that for the rest of their lives. Our next victim is Catherine Bright, and she was 21. Now, Dennis would confess to her murder as well, and when he asked about finding her and choosing her to be the victim, he would actually say he had many projects that he followed people around town. Now, he would describe two stages of identifying an intended victim, the trolling and stalking. You go through trolling first and then stalking. Now, when he'd reached the stalking phase, this would often lead to murder, but not always. So in April 1974, about 3 months after the Otero family murders, he would actually break into Catherine's home and hide in her bedroom. Now, she would return home, but this time with her brother, 19. Now, Dennis was once again surprised by another person. And by chance on that day, Kevin had actually run an errand with her, so he happened to come back. Now, Dennis hadn't bought enough in his little kit for two people, so this would lead to a couple of errors during this particular murder. He would startle them both when he'd emerged from that bedroom, but he'd use that same ruse that had worked on the Otero family. He was a fugitive, he needed money, he needed food, he needed a car. Now, he would say during his confession that the details were a little hazy, but we do get a really general understanding of how everything played out on this bleak day. Now, he would force them into one of the bedrooms where one of them, it's not entirely clear whether it was Kevin or it was Dennis who would end up tying Catherine up. But while Dennis was attempting to tie Kevin up, a fight would ensue. And Kevin almost got the upper hand on this, which is pretty cool. But it would actually end up with Kevin being shot twice, once in the head in particular. Now, Dennis would make the mistake of thinking Kevin was dead, but we're going to come back to that. Now, we go to the bedroom where Catherine was tied up. Now, she'd put up one hell of a fight as well, and he would attempt to strangle her with his hands as well, but he would need to switch up his method. This time, he would end up stabbing her. Kevin would not be dead. Now, he would soon really quickly recover, and he'd escape and run out of the house screaming for help. I don't mean recover. I mean there must have just been a rush of adrenaline for him. So realizing that it wouldn't be long before help the police arrived, Dennis would actually flee the house. Now, at first he would actually attempt to take one of their cars because he had some keys in his hands, but none of the keys that he had, they wouldn't work on any of the cars. So instead he would run back to where his car was parked and he would have to head home. Now, he would be all cleaned up by the time that his wife got home, so no one would suspect what he had done on this day. Now, Catherine would still be alive when the ambulance arrived, but she'd be taken to the hospital where she would die from her injuries. Kevin would survive, but still the scars, not just physically, right, but mentally, stay with him for the rest of his life. In October 1974, Dennis, he wanted an audience to play with, so he would start to contact the media. This is the first podcast, though, that we talk about serial killers contacting the police and the media, but it's definitely not going to be our last. So I just thought I'd let you know that there's quite a bit of contact that he reaches out. An editor from the Wichita Eagle would receive an anonymous phone call telling him of a letter that was in a book in the public library. Now, it intrigued him enough that he'd go and get it, but inside this book would be a letter claiming to take credit for the Otero murders and a promise of more victims to come. The letter would contain certain details of the murder that only the killer would know, so the police definitely knew it was the real deal. the Wichita Eagle would follow a request from the police to not publish the letter, as it would cause quite a stir in the community and it would possibly lead to false confessions. Unfortunately, a reporter from a rival newspaper was able to get a copy and would print parts of this letter. Now, I'm going to read parts of the letter to our viewers and to our listeners. So one of these, so the very first letter that was printed in the Wichita Sun in December 1974. I write this letter to you for the sake of the taxpayers as well as your time. Those three dude you have in custody are just talking to get publicity for the Otero murders. They know nothing at all. I did it by myself and with no one's help. There has been no talk either. Let's put this straight. Now, the killer provides details of the crimes and the crime scene that have not been published in any sort of newspaper. So this is how they know it's the real deal. I'm sorry this happened to society. They are the ones who suffered the most. It's hard to control myself. You probably call me psychotic with sexual perversion hang up. When this monster enter my brain, I will never know, but it's here to stay. How does one cure himself? If you ask for help that you have killed four people, they will laugh or hit the panic button and call the cops. I can't stop it, so the monster goes on and hurt me as well as society. Society can be thankful that there are ways for people like me to relieve myself at time by daydreams of some victims being torture and being mine. It's a big complicated game, my friend, of the monster play, putting victims number down, follow them, checking up on them, waiting in the dark, waiting. The pressure is great, and sometimes he run the game to his liking. Maybe you can stop him. I can't. He has already chosen his next victim or victims. I don't know who they are yet. The next day after I read the paper, I will know, but it is too late. Good luck hunting. Yours, truly guilty. The letter wasn't signed, but it did have a note right at the end. P.S. Since sex criminals do not change their MO or by nature cannot do so, I will not change mine. The code word for me will be bind them, torture, kill them. BTK. You see, he added again, they will be on the next victim. So a letter like that, he's already identified that he's got those perversions. And you can hear in the grammar how it's just really not fantastic. And there's a lot of spelling errors as well, I might add. So it's always really, really hard to know whether they're just trying to trick people. But it was definitely seemed like a game and to say to people, hey, I'm here to stay. So Dennis, he would end up getting a job with ADT Security, a company that installs alarm systems at homes. It's truly frightening for me that he actually kept this job for 14 years. He would eventually be promoted to an installation supervisor, and that allowed him some flexibility to really do whatever he wanted when it came to stalking or trolling. Now, Now, for the next couple of years, Dennis was really busy. The birth of his son, Brian, he had a steady job, he was attending night school, and he's not known to have committed any more murders. Dennis would admit, though, he trolled the whole entire time in between his murders. So I'm not sure that he didn't kill, or maybe he genuinely didn't, as he found other ways to fulfill his fantasies, such as dressing up, tying himself, and taking photos. I'm guessing that if he did kill at all during this time, it's definitely going to be uncovered with the new crime techniques that we've got and certainly through DNA. Now, Dennis would be trolling and he'd find a target in March 1977. But this person was particularly lucky as they weren't home when he'd intended to kill them. Now, upon discovering that his target wasn't home, he would end up trolling this same neighborhood. he'd come upon a boy, a little boy by the name of Steve at Relford. Now, this would be the worst meeting of this boy's lifetime because Dennis would end up knocking on his door and he poses a detective of some sort, but he'd force his way into the home. Now, I think he did this by using a gun, but I'm not really sure. There was another two children home at the time as well, and he had murder on his mind. He's got his murder kit with him. So shortly after scaring the children into letting him into the home, their mum, Shirley, now she'd appear in a bathrobe and she appeared to not be very well. She would immediately demand to know what was going on. He would order the children into the bathroom. And the only reason he would provide the kids with toys, blankets and other things was to keep them occupied and compliant. He would end up blockading the door as well. Now, Dennis would lie to Shirley and tell her that he just wanted to tie her up and take some photos of her. He would certainly tie her up, but he would end up strangling her to death with a rope. He would enjoy it so much, he would need to relieve himself again, but he would leave the evidence behind. Once he'd killed Shirley, the phone would ring and this would startle him. Now, the reason it startled him so much is because he'd actually been told earlier that a neighbour was ringing to check up on Shirley and to make sure that she was okay. So he'd really hastily leave. This phone call would end up saving those kids' lives because he had a plan, he'd said, to actually kill the children as well. Now, they'd end up escaping this bathroom and get help. But really, at what cost? They knew what had happened to their mum. And when the police would arrive, Stephen was able to even give a description. But given his age, the police just weren't sure whether he would be a reliable witness. Now, Nancy Fox would be BTK's next victim. During his confession to her murder, he would admit that he'd stalked her and he'd become really fixated on killing her. In December 1977, he would break into her duplex where she lived and he would cut her phone lines as well. Now, he would allegedly hold her at gunpoint and then say to her, "I've got a sexual issue and I'm going to need to tie you up to rape you." She was surprisingly compliant in this and she'd say, "Just get it over with." I'm really paraphrasing here, guys, but you get the general gist of what we're doing. Now, he'd handcuff her and tie her feet, and he would end up taking out a belt, and he would strangle her with it. Now, after he had killed her, he'd remove those handcuffs and the belts and the ties, and he'd replace it with pantyhose. Now, he would clean himself up, and then he'd take some items from her house before leaving. Perhaps just because he was brazen, or he knew that no one knew who he was, or that he was BTK, but he would call the police dispatcher the following day and say, "Go to this address and you'll find a homicide of Nancy Fox." The media would even play that call to the general public and no one would recognize the voice as Dennis. That absolutely astounds me. He was so brazen that he would do that. But then again, we've actually seen that with, you know, the Grim Sleeper and Lonnie Franklin. He did the exact same thing. So I really think it's to play with the police. And I really just, yeah, really gets me going that they just have a so brazen an attitude. In early 1978, he would send a poem to the Wichita Eagle again. Now, due to some mismatch in some departments, this had actually been missed for several days. This really seemed to upset him and really angered him because he'd send a follow-up letter. This time he would send it to the local TV network and it would say, "How many people do I have to kill before I get my name in the paper or get some national attention?" In this letter, he would take full responsibility for the Otero family, the Shirley, Nancy Fox, as well as an unnamed victim. So this would be presumably Catherine Bright. The letter would also suggest nicknames for himself, but the one that really did stick, guys, was BTK. And in this, he would also include a poem, "O Death to Nancy." Now, the police would end up feeling like their hands had been forced now, and they needed to decide as to what to say to the public. Now, in the end, they would say that there was a serial killer on the loose and you need to be vigilant in locking your doors and to look out for one another. I'm guessing it was probably a hell of a lot more to that sphere, guys, but it was just a really, hey, something's going down. We haven't caught him. You need to be more vigilant. In 1979, Anna Williams, who was 63, she'd be one of the luckiest women on earth. Dennis would wait for hours in her home, and thankfully she didn't come while he was waiting there for her. He'd steal some items from her house. Anna would receive a package a couple of days later and a poem titled, "Oh Anna, Why Didn't You Appear?" And this package would include some items from her home. He would also send a package to the media with the same sort of content. And as you can imagine, Anna would move out of that area pretty darn quickly. But just imagine coming home to that package and having a letter from BTK. You'd just be, no thank you. Now, he would remain dormant through the early 80s. But then again, guys, I just do want to point this out. It doesn't mean he stopped his killings. Maybe we just aren't able to identify more victims at this stage. Now, late in the 1970s, his daughter, Kerry, she'd be born. So it seems like perhaps maybe he was afraid of getting caught, or once again, maybe he found ways to curb his murderous tendencies. Nothing in the media would be heard from BTK until about 2004, but there'd be a letter in 1987, which we're going to go through a little bit later. Now, Dennis, during this time, he'd be really active in his church. He'd become a club scout when his little boy Brian was old enough. So he's really active in the community. In 1985, almost 8 years since his last murder, he'd be 40 years old now, guys. So he'd choose a victim that was probably a little bit easier to kill and to be more compliant. Maureen Hedge was the next victim, and she would live down the street from him, and that's how he discovered her. On the night of the murder in April, he'd break into her home, and she actually happened to be out at that time, and he'd wait until she got home. However, she unexpectedly brought someone home. So rather than killing this person, though, he would wait until Maureen was alone. So once she was alone and in bed, he'd sneak up on her and he'd strangle her. The next part is probably one of the most depraved things that I've ever heard or read about. He'd remove her from her bed and place her in her own car, where he'd take her to his local church. There was a room underneath the church that he had keys to. He would do unspeakable things. It included posing her bodies in different bondage fantasies, and he'd then dump her body in a ditch and somewhat hide the body, but he would leave some pantyhose next to it. Now, he would then dump her car, but he'd come look at the body the next night and take a couple more photos. Now, these photos would be found in his home when he'd be arrested. In September 1986, he'd be walking around the neighborhood and he would hear a piano being played. The person playing this piano would be Vicky Wurchel. Now, he would use a really new way to get into her home, though. He would dress up as a telephone repairman, down to the hat, down to some pretend equipment. Now, she'd be none the wiser, so she would immediately let him into her home. He'd simulate checking the phone, but he would then pull out a gun on her. Now, Vicky was still really quite young, so she fought really hard to stay alive. Unfortunately, it would prove to be futile, as he would eventually be able to secure her with ropes, and he would strangle her with her own nylon stockings. He would then photograph her in different positions, but during the fight of her life, she would tell BTK that her husband was due home shortly. And for some reason, this Dennis left. He didn't even wait for the husband to come home, maybe because he knew he couldn't fight the husband. I don't know. Maybe he knew his age, he was getting on. There was something in him that triggered him to not kill Bill. Now, Bill, Vicky's husband, he would come home, he'd find Vicky, call an ambulance, but she'd be pronounced dead before getting to the hospital. Dennis, meanwhile, he'd driven around the city for a while, disposing of some evidence. Then he returned to the area, dumped Vicky's car a couple of blocks from their home. But Bill's life would really take a turn for the drastic, because not only had he lost his wife and the mother of his two kids, but he was faced with the police being quite hostile and skeptical of him because they didn't believe that he was genuinely innocent of this crime. They actually, he's a suspect for 18 years until BTK came forward. It's just insane. But nobody had heard from BTK in the last 8 years, right? So it didn't connect the dots. So it's just really sad because Bill, he went through hell and back, and that was really, really apparent. At the very end of 1987, another family murder would occur in Wichita. Now, this time it would be three members of the Fager family, the father, Philip, and his two teenage daughters. Now, a contractor who worked for the family was arrested in Florida after leaving the murder scene, and he would end up using a credit card that had been stolen from him. Now, this man in particular was eventually acquitted due to a lack of physical evidence, but the police do remain satisfied, I guess is the word, that he's actually the murderer. But a letter was received by Mrs. Fager in early 1988 from BTK, and he stated that while he did not commit the crime, he admired the work of the man who did. This was never confirmed as a genuine BTK communication until the police would find an original letter in the trap in his house 17 years later. And he would also own an illustration of what he thought had happened to one of those girls. It was not accurate to the crime scene, so they knew that he definitely had committed that crime. But almost 5 years after Vicky's murder, he was 45 years old, so he definitely preferred to keep his victims or projects older. I'm guessing because it's less chance of a man interrupting or possibly being home. So his victims or projects which he picked would often be widows. They'd be people who there was no chance that a man could overthrow him. Now, a woman by the name of Dolores Davis would be the last known victim of Dennis Rader. Now, for this murder, he'd be waiting outside her home, and once he realized that Dolores had gone to bed, he would use a cement block to break the side door. Now, she would be alerted really quickly to this, right? She'd go get out of bed. He'd use the same ruse as he's used before. He was a fugitive. He needed money. He needed a car. Now, he would initially handcuff her, but he changed his mind and then tie her up. So he would also use pantyhose to strangle her, and he did the same thing to Dolores that he'd done with Marie. He'd take her to a remote spot and leave her body there, but he would return the next night to pose her body and take different photos. Only 4 months after the murder of Dolores, Dennis Rader, he'd end up getting a job as compliance and animal control officer at the Park City. So he'd become both a dog catcher and a local code enforcer. Now, he was a part of the local law establishment now, so he gained a bearing reputation as being really efficient. He was really friendly to being really overzealous and really, really petty. He'd write citations for people if the grass height was too high. There were definitely some complaints against him, and there were people that would say that they'd moved away because of the mistreatment. But no complaint was ever, it never had any disciplinary action. So he really got away with a lot because they would often side with him and think that the citizens were just being, whiny, and they didn't like the fines. But I don't know. He got away with so much. So just ridiculous, in my opinion. Now, although Wichita's police had invested about 100,000 hours and at least half a dozen investigations from 1974 until 1991, BTK, he still hadn't been caught. Now, the FBI still said that it was a case at the top of their list. The search for the BTK strangler had been scaled down to just one detective, but that remaining detective on the BTK case would definitely state that they weren't just sitting around. It wasn't just collecting dust. And a direct quote from him would say, "I've been told by the chief that this investigation will stay open until we have no more reasonable leads to follow, and that can be to almost infinity." The investigation would involve thousands of suspects, and it would cost hundreds of thousands of dollars in man hours, travel expenses, telephone bills. You know, they were testing DNA through all of the evidence. Like, they were doing as much as they could. He just hadn't been caught. So there was no way to identify who he was because he wasn't in the system. He'd never been arrested. So a lawyer by the name of Robert Beatty would renew all the interest in the case again. 2003, almost 12 years after Dolores' murder, something really snapped inside Dennis. He wanted the fame for his murders, not some lawyer, because that lawyer wanted to write a book on it and he wanted to, you know, bring it to the surface again. But Dennis would write a total of 11 different communications to different media outlets. It would all start again in March 2004. He would send some photos of Vicky's murder as well as her driver's license. He continued to send various letters identifying his victims and what he'd done to them. Sometimes he'd send puzzles, sometimes he'd send pictures of the victims, various items from their home. But most importantly, it'd be details of the murder that only the killer could know. So the police would definitely know that they were dealing with the BTK. Again, not some hoax. Now, they were able to identify during one of the drop-offs letters that they could see a Jeep Cherokee. Now, either Dennis, he wanted to get caught, or he was just getting really sloppy, or perhaps he just genuinely believed the police. I'm not really sure, but he would ask them if it was possible to trace a floppy disk. This was one of the forms of communication he wanted to send to them in particular. Now, the police would say, "Yeah, sure, it's okay," and he'd end up sending that disk. Now, I'm not sure if he didn't understand technology or how that works, or thought he had deleted everything off that disk, or he just genuinely underestimated the police. But the police would analyze this floppy disk and they'd find something relating to his church and a document relating to someone named Dennis. I'm really simplifying the process, by the way, guys, but I really just don't think we need to get into the nitty-gritty. They would eventually find his name and his address, and they'd start surveillance on him and his home. Now, during one of these times in particular, they would see a Jeep Cherokee in front of his house. Now, that's when they would seek a subpoena to get his daughter's DNA from some medical records, and it was quickly found out that it was a familial match to the semen found at various BTK murder scenes. Now, he would be arrested on February 25th of 2005, he'd really quickly surrender. It was almost as if he knew this was coming. Now, he'd be taken to an interrogation room after his arrest. And at first, he really wouldn't talk too much about his crimes. He was either playing dumb or just choosing to avoid the subject. But when he was confronted about the traced floppy disk and the DNA match, he started to talk, and he just wouldn't stop talking. It's 30 hours of a confession. He would just talk endlessly about his crimes, and he was so proud to be reciting his achievements. It would be about his methods. It all came to light. Now, what I'm going to do next, guys, is I'm just going to give a timeline of how everything ensued after he got arrested. So here's a timeline. So February 28th, 2005, it would be the first appearance for Dennis. It had been scheduled for Tuesday, March 1st at 11 a.m. And all media requests for the hearing must be coordinated through the court's media coordinator, and the charging document would be available on a website. The first appearance of Dennis was to be held on March 1st at 3 p.m., but they said it would be specified at a later date. He'd been arrested and was being held on $10 million probable cause bond. Now, formal charges were to be expected, but at this stage, the charging document had not been available. But on March 1st, 2005, he'd had his first appearance in court, and he was charged with 10 counts for first-degree premeditated murder. And the public defender's office had been appointed to represent him. His preliminary hearing would be scheduled for March 15th, 2005, and he was held at the Sedgwick County Adult Detention Facility whilst on bail. And on March 10th, 2005, the preliminary hearing of the State of Kansas versus Dennis Rader would be have a continuance until April, as per the request of the defense attorneys. But on March 15th, 2005, the DA would respond to a public query regarding the status of the evidence that was taken during the investigation of Joseph Otero, Julie Otero, Josephine Otero, Joseph Otero Jr., Catherine Bright, Shirley Vianne, Nancy Fox, Maureen Hedge, Vicky Wurgel, and Dolores. Now, April 19th, 2005, he would waive his rights at the preliminary hearing, and the the judge would grant an attorney's request that this arraignment now be set for May 3rd. During his arraignment hearing, he wouldn't speak at all. He would enter a not guilty plea. So because he wouldn't speak, the judge actually had to enter a non-guilty plea on his behalf. And the jury trial would be set for June 27th, 2005. Now, the DA would serve the notice of intent to request separate sentencing proceeding for the hard 40. That's 40 years without the possibility of parole for the murder of Dolores Davis. So May 6th, 2005, the defense filed a motion for discovery and requested a hearing. The defendant waived a full and fair hearing, and the state and the defendant agreed that the motion for discovery should only be sustained as to discovery and inspection that is required by statute and case law. And that the defendant's motion should be overruled as to any definitions, discovery, and I don't really know what that means, but I think it's just more lawyer talk in regards to discovery and what we're what the courts were entitled to discover. And the reason I think that behind this on that they stopped a lot of the discovery was because Dennis Rader would enter a guilty plea on those 10 counts of first degree murder. He waived his rights to a jury, deciding that the aggravating circumstances to a jury for the hard 40. So I think what he wanted to do was prevent getting 10 40 hard 40 sentences, and that was really like so that he wouldn't get 400 years. Dude, you're gonna get so many life sentences. But the judge, Waller, he would order a pre-sentence investigation to be completed and will sentence Dennis Rader for all of the murder convictions at a sentencing hearing. Now, on August 11th, 2005, a motion to compel discovery was filed by the state and heard by a judge. The judge sustained the motion. But the sentencing hearing for Dennis Rader was held, and that resulted in the judge imposing 10 life sentences to run consecutively. Now, Judge Waller also imposed the hard 40 for the murder of Dolores Davis. He would be quickly transported to the Kansas Department of Corrections, where he's required to serve 175 years before parole eligibility. So, in the end, for 10 counts of murder, he only got 175 years. I'm guessing it's a lot, but I think the fact that they've even said parole eligibility, he should have never been eligible for parole under any circumstances, as far as I'm concerned. He is still alive at the moment. His daughter has written a book about him. His ex-wife, Paula, now is very much out of the public eye. She's not really been heard of since she divorced him. His son prefers to be out of the limelight as well. I think his daughter's just really trying to comprehend to separate BTK from the father that she knew and loved. So I think it's really important that you go and watch some of those documentaries, because she really does a really good job at explaining herself. But they are really cool. But thank you so much all for listening to episode 11. If you like this podcast, please hit that like button. There's a subscribe button at the end of the video, so go ahead and subscribe if you want to, or go and listen to other episodes if you are new. But I do hope you all have a fabulous weekend, my fellow peanuts. Thank you.